You know, I like those commanders that earmark time in their diary just to wander. You know, wander, sit on people's desks, find out what, you know, is gripping them. And it takes a real effort to preserve that. You know, I'm not sure I've always been very good at it myself, but I admire those that can do it, because, you know, it makes a massive difference if those workers see those commanders engaging at a sort of grassroots level.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody. This is Ben Morton, and welcome to episode 33 of the show. In this episode, we are so lucky to be joined by General Sir James Everard, KCB, CBE. James became a commissioned officer in the British Army in 1983. He joined the 17th 21st Lancers and has extensive operational experience, having commanded at every level in the British Army, including the Queen's Royal Lancers, 20th Armoured Brigade, 3 UK Division, and the UK Field Army. He served as the UK Liaison Officer at the Pentagon as a one-star general, at the UK Ministry of Defence as the Assistant Chief of the General Staff, a two-star general position, and as the Deputy Chief of the Defence Staff, Military Strategy and Operations as a three-star general. His final appointment before retiring in September 2020 was as Deputy Supreme Allied Commander Europe for NATO. James recently took up the appointment of Lead Senior Mentor for NATO Allied Command Operations in January 2021, where along with the other senior mentors, he provides high-level coaching, advice and support for NATO commanders. This is a truly fascinating episode, folks, not least because James's experience ranges from leading 11 soldiers and 3 tanks all the way up to leading tens of thousands of troops and having influence over millions in his final role. We touch on and cover a lot of ground, including leadership transitions, operating in a VUCA world, discipline, high-performing teams, and the importance of happiness even, which I must admit, I didn't expect a retired NATO general to be talking about happiness in regards to leadership. So, without any further delay, please enjoy my conversation with General Sir James Everard. James, good morning and a very warm welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today. How are you and how's your week been so far?
Good morning, Ben. I'm well and my week has been good.
Good to hear. James, can we start off straight away, please, by just telling us a little bit about the job you've fairly recently retired from? Because I think it's very different, to say the least, to other guests that we've had on the show so far. So, yeah, if you tell us the job and perhaps a little bit of the journey that got you there, please, that would be amazing.
Okay, Ben. So I'm a soldier. I joined the army in 1982. And my last job, and I finished that in April last year, was the rather lofty title of Deputy Supreme Allied Commander Europe. And that's in Allied Command Operations. That's the military wing of NATO, recognising this is a political-military alliance. And since 1949, the Supreme Allied Commander has always been an American, and his deputy has always been British. And the role involves not only doing everything that he doesn't want to do, but in simple terms, you are responsible for generating the forces that the alliance needs to conduct the various missions, operations and activities that are all slightly different that the North Atlantic Council decide that they are going to do. And so it's a, you know, it's a great job and it gets you around all 30 nations in the alliance. And, you know, I really enjoyed it.
That's great, James. And considering you've had such an incredible career in the armed forces, this question could fill the entire show, but there must be so many really valuable leadership lessons that you've picked up along the way. But if you were to pick, say, 2 or 3 that have really stood out for you that would be valuable for those leading teams, organisations in the business world? What would some of those lessons that have really stood out for you be?
As context, Ben, I think just 2 points before I pick my two. And I think the first point, of course, is that anybody can learn, you know, to be a better leader primarily by watching others and through personal experience. And I think I certainly have. And as you do that, you develop your own approach to leadership, a leadership framework, you know, that guides you and is probably easy to brief so that others understand the way you think. And the other sort of point of contact is everybody makes mistakes. And so, you know, it's a constant process. But my two big lessons, I think point one would be, you know, listen, that great phrase that God gave you two ears and one mouth for a reason. And this asks, I think, people to be ever mindful that others have may have thought through things more deeply than you have. And so, you know, give them space. And then secondly, and I suppose they're linked, you know, do not be afraid to confess your ignorance, or if you prefer, be alert to your own ignorance. And I think there's something here about taking pride and joy in learning. So those are my two, you know, listen and don't be afraid to confess your ignorance.
And James, do you think listening gets harder the more senior you become, either because of the structures that might be in place in the organization within which you work? Are you going to be farther removed from the front line, to use that phrase? Or does it potentially get harder because you've got more experience and there's always the trap that you could think that you know the answer because I've experienced this before? And if that's the case, how can senior leaders sort of guard against that, do you think?
I think it probably does get harder purely because you get busier and the pressure on one's own time, you know, ever grows. And of course, as you grow through an organization, you do learn about it. And so you have that sense sometimes when you're being briefed that you know, get on with it. I know this. When I talked about watching people, my first American boss in NATO was a American paratrooper called Curtis Scaparotti. And genuinely, I haven't met anybody who understood 21st century warfighting in the way that he did. And yet he had this absolute discipline, you know, that if people were pitched to give him 10 minutes on a certain subject, he would listen. A, it made people feel good. It made them feel that they were contributing. And, you know, often he would pick up on something that had changed or just shaped his thinking. So I think there's a bit of personal discipline here. You know, force yourself to listen. You know, give people the space. And I think you end up running a happier organisation. And it's an aside, but I've always found that headquarters that are happy tend to be a little more effective than those ones that are just driven.
Yeah, it's fascinating to hear you say that, James, because I think certainly in the business world, in sort of the business development and psychology world, probably over the past 10 years maybe, there's been quite a lot of research coming out of Harvard, Stanford, kind of all the great kind of colleges and institutions, UCL, places like that, that talk about happiness at work. And I think it's quite easy to view that with a degree of skepticism, cynicism, like does that really kind of make a difference to the organization's performance? Or if it's a corporate organization, does it really make a difference to the bottom line? And I don't think most listeners would probably expect a very senior army officer to come on and start talking about happiness being something that's important to effectiveness. So it's not a particularly well-framed question, but I just wonder kind of if you've got any other thoughts you would share around that happiness piece, because it caught me by surprise, I must admit, having spent a short career in the military.
I think it was interesting. I was very honoured to represent Her Majesty the Queen at a passing off parade at Sandhurst, and there's quite a good discipline in the speech you make to, you know, the cadets on parade, because, you know, it needs to be 5 minutes and it needs to hopefully be vaguely impactful on the way they're thinking. And I think one of the points I made there is, you know, when you're young, you probably haven't got the ability to make big decisions, you know, to have a massive impact, but you can really focus on the small things that make an immediate difference to your soldiers and their families, you know, where they might be posted next, you know, they're having a problem with their kids at school, all that sort of stuff. I do think that the better commanders, and again, I talk about watching and learning, you know, the better commanders retain this ability, not just to focus on the big things, but on the small things, say, that make a difference to people and make them happy. And I'd say, you know, Mike Jackson, I was his military assistant for 2 years, you know, a great gift, from ranging from the massively strategic issues down to the minutiae of, you know, problems that the wives were having and fixing them. So I suppose you're talking about delivering happiness because you've just improved the quality of their life and show that you care. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes absolute sense, James. And it's fascinating. I think from my time at Sandhurst, probably one of the lessons that I remember most clearly and has endured for me was consciously, deliberately, unconsciously, subliminally. I just have this sense that it was drummed into us again and again just how important it was to get to know your soldiers, and not in a sort of unhealthy way, but just know everything about them. And that real emphasis and focus on relationship building, I'm not sure that is done perhaps quite as well in all parts of the corporate world, because they can just become so obsessed with execute the task, kind of hit the number. But it's relationships, as you said, are absolutely vital to good, effective leadership, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. And of course, when you start off in the army, in my case, in a tank regiment, I mean, you're commanding very few people, you know, 3 tanks and 11 soldiers, you know, and so you really can get to know them well, you know, their fears, their desires, their aspirations. You know, you can take the time to put a program of personal development in place for each of them that hopefully means they will achieve the most they're ever going to achieve, you know, those sort of things. And again, of course, it grows much more difficult as the scale grows difficult. And it might be you're working through other people, but you can still achieve the same effect. And I come back to it, if people feel that, you know, the leadership care, then they're going to work harder for you, which is, of course, the bonus.
And James, you started by sharing a couple of your leadership lessons. If I was to flip that question, what is sort of the one or two pieces of advice that you were given that really stands out? So what was perhaps the best two bits of advice you was given as a leader throughout your career?
And I think I was lucky joining the 21st Lancers, you know, long time based in Germany, Cold War, a reputation for sort of work hard, play hard. But you know, perhaps at the time I didn't realise how good they were. And I've now, you know, visited probably hundreds of units in my time. But I remember my first commanding officer, literally on my first day, you know, telling me that, you know, decisions are the lifeblood of any organisation. And at every stage of your career, you need to actively seek them out and make them. And I think his point was, and this is another point I made in my speech at Sandhurst, is, you know, if you get a reputation for finding ways to say, you know, yes, as opposed to excuses for saying no, then you're going to go far, because people like a doer, they like a fixer, they like a problem solver as part of their team. So I think that big bit of advice, you know, decisions, you know, make them. And then a sort of cautionary add-on, which tells you that, you know, when you're at your best, you're also at your most vulnerable, you know. And you see this time and time again, you know, when things are going really, really well, you know, this is the time to really concentrate as a leader, otherwise you get bitten. And you know, I'm not sort of going to into philosophy here, but I always thought there was that wonderful Asari's law on the conservation of evil, which tells you that the total amount of evil in any system is always constant. And so just as you do well here, the balloon is squeezing out elsewhere. And you'll know this, you know, probably, do you remember the sort of history we had? And I think it's hopefully squashed now in large part, but the initiation ceremonies and all these things, you know, probably the better the unit, the more danger was that people felt there should be some initiation ceremony to get into it, you know, which is the evil part. You know, again, I think those days have gone, but my point was, you know, really concentrate when things are going well, because, you know, that's when you get bitten.
Yeah, that's great. And James, you will have gone through so many what I'd describe as leadership transitions in your career, as you've stepped into bigger and bigger leadership roles, which is something, again, in the corporate world, we speak about quite a lot, sort of how do you manage those? So I wonder, what would you say were some of the most challenging transitions or step changes. How did you manage those? And if and how your leadership style and approach changed as a result, if indeed it did at all?
So I think we've touched on this a bit. You know, when I joined the army, you know, I commanded, what, 3 tanks, 11 soldiers. You know, as commander field army, you command just over 60,000 soldiers. And then as DSACR, you have sort of influence over millions. And I think scale does present its own challenges because the gap between the leader and the led grows. You know, you have to work much harder to establish, you know, unity of purpose. You've got to work much harder to ensure everybody is on message. And I don't think your leadership framework needs to change. Perhaps it shouldn't change because, you know, people have promoted you, recognizing that you're doing something right in your previous job. You know, the leadership focus doesn't change. I think one can still be kind. One perhaps has to be increasingly firm. And with this absolutely underlying principle, I've talked about making people happy and being kind, but actually your underlying leadership message is you will just not accept apathy in those that you lead. And so if you have people who simply can't get with the program, who are simply fiercely independent and want to do their own thing, then get rid and find someone that will.
Quick one for you folks, and apologies for butting into my own podcast, but I just wanted to pop up and say that if you're enjoying this episode, then do also check out episode 57 with General David Petraeus, which I know you will love. General Petraeus is a former senior officer in the US military with 6 consecutive commands, 5 of which were in combat. And following his military career, he went on to be director of the CIA. I've included the link to episode 57 with General Petraeus in the show notes, so you can click on that and go straight there as soon as you finish listening to this episode. But enough from me. Back to the episode you're listening to right now. And do you think that is there any change between leading some individuals who are responsible for doing a particular task, i.e. not responsible for leading any other people themselves, versus leading a team of very senior leaders who themselves are responsible for huge units, organizations, hundreds of people themselves? Does that kind of change your approach at all, or does the framework stay the same?
You know, it's a really good question, isn't it? Because the most junior soldier just doing his job, you know, each has to be treated as an individual because they'll all have different abilities, capabilities, you know, desires, ambitions. So, you know, that won't surprise you. I think it gets more difficult as you get higher because the people who occupy your command group, to use, you know, a military expression, you know, probably your board. I mean, they're all active thinkers themselves. They've all got their own ideas. And of course, what you really want to do is co-opt the best of those ideas in one's own thinking. It comes back to this ability to listen. And but of course, we have this advantage perhaps in the army that in the end, you know, the senior officer makes the decision. And unless people have real, real problems with it, in which case they'll probably tell you, people turn to the right and get on with it. And so, you know, you do establish unity of purpose and effort throughout the chain of command.
And changing tack ever so slightly, James, and sort of thinking about teams here, if you was to cast your mind back to some of the very best teams in the military that you've either led yourself or perhaps been a member of, can you put your finger on what you would say are perhaps some of the distinguishing factors or traits that made them so effective? Or I guess to put the question another way is what I'm really asking is your view on what makes a truly high-performing team.
People have to understand that it's not individual brilliance that matters, but the commitment by the individual to the greater good. And, you know, I use the word Jedi. These are our sort of absolute A-streamers who, even at a young age, you can see getting to, you know, senior rank. And I've been, you know, lucky enough to have been supported by some real Jedi in my time. And were they all aware of their brilliance? I think they were. But they absolutely recognised my desire that they channel this to the collective good. And the ones that have gone furthest did that the best. Is that awful? Was it, you know, no I in team and all these sort of things? It's the same point, but I think, you know, people understand this when you can say that to any rank. Yeah, I want you to do well, but you know, it's your brilliance that makes us better.
It's interesting. You mentioned there that there's no I in team. Maybe this comes with age. I'm not sure, but more and more I find that so many of those cliches that get banded around and used, I think they're cliches because there's a lot of truth in them.
No, I think you're absolutely right. It's not training if it's not raining. You know, all these things, you'll know them. and they're all rooted in some worthy point.
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing I'd like to ask you about, James, is the VUCA acronym. Mm. Now, that's something that I can easily get on a bit of a soapbox around this one. It's a phrase that's kind of swept into the business world in a big way, probably in the past 5 to 10 years, last 12 months, it's been thrown around a lot. I mean, depending on what you read and study, some people, some institutions suggest that this requires leaders to adopt a whole new raft of leadership skills and an approach, which I find interesting because as far as I can see, sort of the VUCA environment, that volatile, uncertain, complex and ambiguous, that's been the case for militaries all around the world since people first took up arms against each other. But from your military experience, are there any particular tips or tactics or approaches that you think help leaders to lead effectively in this environment?
It's interesting. I haven't heard VUCA being used for a while, you know, volatility, uncertainty, complexity, ambiguity. I mean, I remember it. And I think the big point here is that language is important, and it's just very human to search for a bumper sticker, a strap line, a set of bullets that makes what is very complicated just that bit easier to understand. And I think there is a lesson here in the value of simplicity, particularly if you're trying to establish unity of understanding across a large body of people. You know, you break the problem down, you explain the nature of the strategic challenge by simplifying, you know, the sometimes overwhelming complexity of the language. And this is where these bullets or things emerge, you know. And I think in NATO now you'll have this long list of outthinking, out excelling, out fighting, out pacing, you know, out partnering, out lasting your opponent. That again is a sort of summary of a sort of 30-page paper that tells you how you might do it. So I absolutely recognise the value of these things, and I like them more when they are proactive. In other words, they're things you can do, you know, rather than words that just simplify a 10-page booklet or something.
Yeah, and James, from your experience, if we use this phrase, when all hell is breaking loose, when things suddenly become complex and chaotic and confusing, what can we do as leaders to operate effectively in those moments? I mean, the thing that springs to mind for me is, I guess, in the military, is what we would describe as command time, or I think I remember my time at Sandhurst, I remember this being described as the Panama or Hamlet moment. But what would your advice be on that? Sort of when you're in kind of corporate headquarters, it feels like the whole world is collapsing around you. What would your advice be?
Well, I think we're lucky in the military that we train our commanders and our headquarters to be very happy with an incomplete operational picture, you know, surprise, you know, all those time pressure, you know, all those things that might spin organizations out of control. We like to think we've thought about it, and we tend to have processes that allow you to break down that challenge and respond in an ordered fashion. But I think in terms of a leader, and I think, you know, there is no more important activity than command and control, you know, particularly when you're in a fight or under supreme pressure. That is the example of the commander. And, you know, you'll know that old phrase, you know, we talked about these things being trotted out, but if you can keep your mind, your humour, everything else, then it, you know, it gives people confidence, and very soon the team will rally and you're back. So I think it is, you know, leading by example, but also making very good use of the processes that you will have built up over time.
And last of the slightly longer questions, James, before we move on to just a couple of slightly quicker fire questions to wrap up. Perhaps this is as a result of COVID, I'm not sure, but in my work, I've noticed over the last 12 months, I'm being asked a lot more about my thoughts around discipline and helping leadership teams to instill greater discipline for themselves and for the organizations that they lead. And as I think about this, it strikes me that in the business world, there's this tendency to constantly be making changes, be that to meeting agendas, the rhythm and cadence of meetings, reports, reporting cycles, like the list goes on and on and on. And while some of these changes will be ineffective and as a result they get abandoned, which is probably exactly the right thing to do, it appears that there are others that would be very effective for the team or the organization, but the team struggle to embed them, perhaps because they lack the discipline to follow through. Now, I think, yes, in the military, they are lucky that they have the advantage of probably there's people in post who it's their responsibility to ensure discipline, right? There's kind of military law, and everybody who joins the military goes through their training, which instills that. But all of that aside, if a MD or CEO came to you and said, oh, James, I just need to get my team and organization being more disciplined, with your sort of consultant's hat on, what would your answers, suggestion, advice be?
Do you know, Ben, I've just been jotting down, and there's so many points in your question. I mean, I think, you know, when we look out at business, you know, one of the big lessons they appear to have learned is this big fear that, you know, you're not doing the wrong thing. You just end up doing the same thing for too long and then you lose competitive edge. And so there's always this pressure to constantly adapt. You know, you bring in the management consultants, out come the list of recommendations, and then you're off. And I think, you know, my first point is that, you know, not all change is good. And I think one needs to be pretty selective. And when you go for significant change, it needs to be all in. You know, it needs to be, in my case, command-led. It needs to be led by the board, because if they're disinterested or half-enthusiastic, then as we know, it'll die a death. So I think you have to back your winners and not even let, you know, the bad ideas get running. And I think as well, you know, going back to a senior level, you know, and I'm not necessarily saying that we're all very good at this, but I do think that at a personal level, the more senior you become, the better your self-discipline needs to be. So you need to be on time. You need to keep on time. You need to be, you know, approachable. And this is difficult. I mean, if I use that term, Praetorian Guard, particularly on operations, you tend to be surrounded by a Praetorian Guard who run your life, who run your diary, who book your helicopters, all that sort of stuff. Under massive pressure, they always overfill it. And then they restrict access to you as a commander because, you know, they know you need time to think, you need time to work on the big issues. But actually in doing so, they divorce you from the staff. And then you lose focus on, as I said, not only on the big things, but the small things that make an immediate difference to your people, even on operations. And that sense of collective spirit just wanes. So, you know, personal discipline here is important. And, you know, I like those commanders that earmark time in their diary just to wander, you know, wander, sit on people's desks, find out what, you know, is gripping them. And it takes a real effort to preserve that. You know, I'm not sure I've always been very good at it myself, but I admire those that can do it because, you know, it makes a massive difference if those workers see those commanders engaging at a sort of grassroots level. And then personal discipline, I've said it before, it also involves some steel, I think. You know, I talked about apathy, but, you know, apathy, it is a cancer. It just leads to mediocrity. And so, you know, you can't tolerate it. You know, people have to be committed. They have to work to the greater good. And if they're only interested in self, then, you know, they need to go.
I mean, that's really insightful, James, what you've just shared. I mean, it's fascinating, actually, when you was talking about the Praetorian Guard. What was going through my mind is that it circles us right back to the start of our conversation today around listening, right? Sort of it, those structures, people running your diary, potentially, as you said, limits access to you, which makes it harder for you to hear what's going on unless you actively carve out and protect that time to wander around and sit on people's desks. If I sort of, I know it's been 12 months since any of us have really been in them, but if I picture corporate headquarters of all the big companies, to get to the CEO, you've literally got to get past the PA whose desk is outside there, is almost guarding access to their physical space and also to their diaries. So it's,
yeah, which is why we're all nice to PAs. You know, you have to be, otherwise your life becomes, you know, almost impossible.
Yeah, absolutely. James, a few quick fire questions to finish up, if I may. What would you say are one or two books that have really had a significant impact on you, or perhaps the one or two books that you find yourself frequently recommending to other people?
It's almost an impossible question. I'm sitting here in my converted garage surrounded by, I don't know, thousands of books. I think, you know, I read a lot. You know, I love to be surprised, you know, when you find often something in a secondhand book that educates you. You know, perhaps I should say, if I'm ever asked by an American for a book that will help them understand the nature of the British soldier, or in this case, actually Scottish, but I would recommend Quartered Safe Out Here by George MacDonald Fraser. Also, of course, famous for writing the Flashman novels, but it follows his experience as a private soldier fighting in the Burma campaign, and, you know, the humour, the complete lack of hubris, you know, everything else that underpins a good infantry fighting battalion just, you know, washes out. So, you know, that's the book I give to people when I'm, you know, travelling, if I can get a hold of copies. I think it's really good. I'm big focused on Russia at the moment. I think, you know, Russia is recognised as a threat by NATO. I think if I have a concern, it's the fact that we don't understand the Russians very well. And actually yesterday a book arrived from the States by Edward Cruikshank, who was a journalist, I think, in Russia in the war. This was a book published in 1948, I think. You know, Russia and the Russians. I was reading that on the bus this morning as I was off to go and get my COVID test. And again, you know, I think those sort of books, you know, they knew so much in those days that we seem to have forgotten. And actually on my bedside table, it sounds like I have no, you know, alternative life, but Future War and the Defence of Europe, a book by John Allen, who you'll probably know, Ben Hodges, you know, former US Commander of Europe, and Julian Lindley French, you know, one of our sort of wisest academics, came out literally, I think, 2 weeks ago. And I'm probably halfway through that and really enjoying it.
Great, thank you. And do you have any particular routines, ways of working, sort of work-based habits that are particularly effective of you? You know, that's certainly something people listening to the show are always curious to know about, kind of how do senior leaders run their lives? How do they behave? What do they do to play at their best? Is there anything there that's interesting to share with people listening?
Nothing original, I fear. I mean, I think that there is something about fitness of body and fitness of mind. You know, if you're overweight and just look unhealthy, I think it's not very inspiring. And you know, I like to swim, and certainly when I was in NATO, I'd swim for an hour every morning, and I think that sets you up for the day. At the moment, there's not much swimming going on, so I'm back to running. But I, you know, I think exercise is really important. I think it just helps. And I often find, you know, when you're running or swimming, that problem, that phrase that you've just been unable to put your finger on, it just comes to you naturally. So I think that is important. And again, you know, your mother probably told you this, you know, everything in moderation. I mean, I just don't drink from Sunday night through to Thursday, because I think it does slow you down. So they're two very boring sort of lifestyle choices, but I think they keep you younger for longer.
Yeah, no drinking on school night.
No, that's right.
And James, final question. What are you perhaps most looking forward to as, in the UK at least, hopefully we start to emerge out of COVID-19?
Well, here we are in March. And actually, I'm actually travelling to the US tomorrow for 3 weeks work at Fort Hood. And I'm so excited about that because, you know, I'm going to meet up with a whole bunch of mostly American mentors who, and a French actually there as well, who I know well, but I just haven't seen. And I think, you know, that social interaction, you know, is so important. And I think we've all learned to love, you know, the technology that brings us, you know, virtual communication. I think it's been very powerful, but I think it's lost its luster a bit for me. So back to personal contact, back to those, you know, conversations that unpick complicated problems. That's what I'm looking forward to.
That's great. James, thank you so much for giving up your time today from the conversation we had before I hit record. I know you're a very busy man despite having retired last year. So thank you for your time and safe travels for when you head out to the States next week, I think. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Ben.
I hope you found that conversation valuable, folks, but most importantly, I really hope that you're able to go away and make some small positive changes as a result. If you did get value from this episode, then please do rate, review, and subscribe via iTunes, as it really does enable us to keep bringing you more and more interviews with fantastic leaders and subject matter experts. Do also visit ben-morton.com, where you can connect with me, find out more about my leadership mentoring and team development work, along with details of all of my online programs via the tools and resources page. That's it for this episode. See you again in the next one very soon, and lead on.